Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Healthcare was a big talking point during last night's debate, and it'll likely be center stage again tonight. However, if you're still unclear about what policies like Medicare for All really mean, we'll lay it out in an easy-to-understand way. Plus, California's farmers need sun and a lot of water to grow crops, but as H2O gets scarce, find out why some are looking to the sky to keep their farms afloat. It's all ahead on Take Two.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. I know it's Wednesday, but it is the most Tuesday-feeling Wednesday I have ever felt. Really. We're at the halfway mark, so we're going to get you over the hump. Coming up, there's a new proposal from the city's petroleum administrator on what to do with the dozen or so oil drilling operations in town. Yeah, there's quite a few, and you may not even know where they are. More on that in about 20 minutes. Plus, we'll go on the lot to learn how filmmakers made Pacino and Niro look decades younger in the upcoming film, The Irishman. But we start today with an eye on Detroit, Michigan. That's where 10 presidential hopefuls met to duke it out on issues ranging from race to healthcare. And in case you missed it, here's a little recap.
If it's true that if we embrace a far left agenda, they're going to say we're a bunch of crazy socialists. If we embrace a conservative agenda, they're going to say we're a bunch of crazy socialists. So let's just stand up for the right policy, go out there and defend it.
Medicare for All is comprehensive. It covers all healthcare needs.
I have a better path. Medicare for America.
I just have a better way to do this.
My plan, Better Care, is fully paid for.
What do you say to Congressman Delaney?
You're wrong.
You can't just spring a plan on the world and expect it to succeed.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
If you think any of this wonkiness is going to deal with this dark psychic force of the collectivized hatred that this president is bringing up in this country, then I'm afraid that the Democrats are going to see some very dark days.
KPCC's Libby Denkman spent the evening with some very engaged voters in Studio City. She's here with their reactions. Hello, Libby.
Hey, A, and shout out to Austin Cross for that great audio montage. Very nicely
how
done.
About that? Well, it's his job, Libby.
Musical.
I mean, don't prop him up too much. All right, so who did you hang out with for the debate?
I met up with the San Fernando Valley Young Democrats and the Stonewall Democratic Club of Los Angeles. They were having a watch party at Jalapeno Pete's restaurant on Ventura Boulevard. It was a really diverse crowd, and many of them were current or former political staffers. So these are very plugged in folks. Primary voters usually are compared to general election voters, but this crowd definitely was heavy on the political geek side.
All right. So if they have strong political beliefs, are they also hardcore fans of certain candidates? Are their minds all the way made up already?
Surprisingly, no. I assume this would be a really Kamala Harris friendly crew because it's a home crowd for the California candidate. But the majority of this group was undecided, or they were leaning toward a few top favorites. Elizabeth Warren was right up there with Harris. Several folks mentioned Pete Buttigieg and even Julian Castro as candidates they've been impressed by. There were some strong Bernie Sanders supporters in the room. He has maintained his fans from 2016, like Myra Valadez. She appreciates how he speaks about economic justice.
I like the fact that Bernie jumped in and said that a lot of the reason why cities like Detroit and others in the Midwest have suffered from poverty has been because of globalization and deunionization. He is an old white Jewish guy from Brooklyn, and I am...
All right, now, on the issues, we're going to save the big one for last, and that's healthcare. But I want to ask about immigration first. Not a big topic last night, but it matters to a lot of people right here.
Yeah, Matthew Contreras is with the Stonewall Democratic Club. He says any Democratic candidate who wants to compete for this state's motherload of delegates, they'll have to provide an ironclad pledge to solve family separations at the border and fix the country's broken immigration system. He said he appreciated Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg standing behind promises to decriminalize crossing the border without documentation. They say they'll repeal the section that makes the section of law that makes improper entry into the U.S. a federal misdemeanor. And that's what's allowed President Trump to separate families under his zero tolerance policy. Here's Matthew Contreras talking about that.
California in general has such a large Hispanic population. I think that differentiation is really important, and it's something that we need to talk about. There are people just like us.
So Matthew's parents were undocumented in the U.S. for a long time. He watched them get treated like criminals when he was growing up. So this is very close to his heart. And it's so interesting that decriminalization wasn't on a lot of candidates' radars in the early part of the race, but Julian Castro raised it in the first round of Democratic debates in that clash with Beto. Yeah, very memorable. It's now become a litmus test for this field of candidates.
All right. There's been a lot of talk lately about statements President Trump has made in recent weeks about Chairman Elijah Cummings' district in Maryland, and also suggesting that four Democratic congresswomen leave the United States. How did this crowd think the candidates did addressing issues of race?
I spoke to Andrew Lewis. He says he's mixed race, he's African American, and his mother is an immigrant from Peru. He says it was important to hear Democrats in the debate talk about the impact of structural racism on people of color and reject racist statements from the White House.
You know, I think following the week that we had with President Trump and him just explicitly going after city of Baltimore and just black folks in general, I'm glad that they addressed it head on.
All right. Finally, one more big topic, and that's health care. We're seeing this conversation within the Democratic Party over how to expand health coverage for all Americans. This turned into a pretty fierce confrontation between moderates and progressives last night. Libby, what did the crowd at your watch party think of that one?
A lot of them said they felt like it was Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders acting as a team, defending
Sanders.
A ticket, maybe? Oh, I don't know if I'd go that far yet, but they definitely were in concert with each other on the Medicare for All plan that Sanders penned. That would phase out private insurance to create a single-payer system covering everyone, no copays, no deductibles. Well, the moderates like former Congressman John Delaney, Montana Governor Steve Bullock, attacked that plan as being too expensive or politically risky. And that tension played out in my conversations with young Democrats last night. Drexel Hurd is with the Stonewall Democratic Club of L.A. He says he thinks expanding health care is a moral issue, but he's worried about Democrats' electability in 2020 if they go all in on ending private health insurance.
Majority of Democrats are moderate. Just because you're the loudest does not make you the majority. And I think that's what people forget. In Los Angeles, we have a lot of studios with union members who know their benefits could be affected by something like Medicare for All.
On the other hand, Vanessa Carr, who works for a local Los Angeles politician, she says she gets the electability argument, but she thinks a bold plan is what's needed.
I get it, but for millions of families in this country, including my own, we've had to have those discussions where it was like, are we paying the rent this month or are you going to the doctor?
So these are big questions. It's important, though, to point out how far this conversation has shifted from 2016. Pretty much every Democratic candidate on that stage was in favor of some version of a public option, which is a huge shift in the landscape from just a few years ago.
All right, that's KPCC's Libby Denkman. Libby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
And as you just heard from Libby, health care loomed large in Michigan last night, and it's likely to play a large role tonight. Now, by this point, you've probably heard a lot about two dueling proposals, Medicare for All and a public option. But what do they really mean? We're going to get some answers from KPCC healthcare reporter Michelle Faust-Dragobin. Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
All right. As mentioned, healthcare, big topic last night. Tonight, Senator Kamala Harris will likely weigh in on that. She just released a proposal of her own on Monday that might be part of the debate tonight. With that, I want to ask you about some key terms that might get thrown around this evening, starting with a popular one, and that's Medicare for All. What is Medicare for All?
Well, I'm going to back up just a moment and say that there is Medicare for All, there's public option, but there are many different styles of Medicare for All, and there are very many styles of a public option. Let's just start with Medicare for All that Bernie has been selling. He's talking about a single-payer, Canadian-like program, no deductibles, no premiums. Basically, health care is paid by the state directly to your provider.
100%.
There you go. So that's covered by your taxes instead of you paying out of pocket. Kamala Harris is looking at a Medicare. It's kind of like a Medicare Advantage. So Medicare Advantage, if you look at Medicare right now, it's not like what Bernie is talking about. It is different than that. Kamala Harris is talking about something that would look a little bit more similar to what Medicare looks like now with Medicare Advantage plans, allowing people to buy private health insurance that covers you under Medicare. So that would be the difference. She's also looking at making a little bit more rules around those health insurers. So that they are hopefully caring for people a little bit better.
Now, more moderate candidates might be throwing their weight behind another idea, a so-called public option, or essentially a government-backed insurance plan. How would that one work?
Well, Joe Biden is one person who's been saying he wants to add to the Affordable Care Act. And
he helped build it.
He was around when it happened, right? So he is looking at a public option. There's different types of public options that people could buy into. The idea of the public option is that it would create competition between the private insurers that already exist and the government-sponsored plans, potentially making all plans lower.
Now, both ideas have faced some criticism. On the public option, some experts have said that instead of building on the Affordable Care Act, it could actually destabilize it. How might that happen?
Well, it's not sure, right? But what I just said was that it could create some more competition, but that extra competition might mean lower prices. If you're a private health insurer, you may not want to play on that field where you're making less money. So that could be part of the destabilization, but it's really unsure. But there are already some public options that exist. Here in LA, we have LA Care that provides Medicare, a Medi-Cal recipients, but also people can buy in on the ACA for that.
All right, that's KPCC healthcare reporter Michelle Faust-Raghavan. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Although climate change was not a hot topic during the Democratic debate last night, it is a major concern for Californians statewide. That's according to a new report from the Public Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. Joining me now is Survey Director Mark Baldessari. Welcome back to Take Two.
Hello.
Now, Mark, how was the poll distributed and results collected? Outline for us the scope of who was polled.
We interviewed 1,706 California adult residents in English and Spanish over a 10-day period. This is the annual environment survey that we've been conducting since the year 2000.
The poll asked Californians for their take on environmental issues over the long term. Broadly speaking, how do people feel about climate change in the state?
In this year's survey, as we found in the past, most Californians believe that climate change is something that is already happening. About two-thirds of Californians say that global warming has already begun. About 8 in 10 Californians say that global warming is either a very serious or somewhat serious threat to California's future.
Mark, when we talk about climate here, it's almost a reflex at this point to bring up wildfires. And your poll found that 63% of Californians acknowledge the role of global warming. What was the response toward wildfire prevention and how citizens can help with that?
Well, first of all, 71% of Californians said that they're very concerned that wildfires will become more severe as a result of global warming. We also asked if Californians were in favor of the actions the governor and legislature have taken to create a wildfire insurance fund, which includes contributions both from ratepayers and utility investors. And about 6 in 10 Californians said that they were in favor. So generally speaking, wildfires are something which now become very closely associated with global warming, and the public want the governor and legislature to do something about, and they're glad that some first steps have been taken.
We're talking about what Californians think about climate change with Mark Baldessari from the Public Policy Institute. Now, circling back a bit to the politics of this, because the environment tends to be a very partisan issue. Was this something that Californians got behind, or did you see splits along party lines?
We see splits along party lines with climate change, both perceptions as well as support for the state's actions. You know, when we first started asking about the state's actions 10 years ago, there was less of a party split than there is today. So you find substantial numbers of Republicans who support actions involving climate change, but you find overwhelming proportions of Democrats who say that they support it. And that's because Democrats and Republicans have very different attitudes about the leadership in Washington today, particularly the Trump administration. Whereas about 9 in 10 Democrats say they disapprove the policies of President Trump, nearly 9 in 10 Republicans at this point are saying that they're in favor of Trump's actions on a number of domains. And this affects how people think about issues like climate change and why it is seen through a partisan lens today.
wondering, is this a driving issue for some Californians as they consider their presidential candidates and who they might choose?
Well, about half of the likely voters in our survey said that they thought that environmental issues were going to be important to them in selecting a presidential candidate. That was around 2 out of 3 Democrats. This is going to be a major factor when people are thinking about who they're going to vote for in the primary and general election next year.
Now, we mentioned how it might be an indicator of voting patterns, and some results suggest that taxpayers are ready to put up money to tackle environmental issues through policies such as, say, gas taxes. I'm wondering, how does this survey and ones like it push policy forward in California?
You know, the purpose of our survey is really to give policymakers a chance to hear from the public directly about how they think about the problems in the state and the solutions. When we listen to the voice of Californians on issues involving climate change, we hear Californians who are very concerned. They want the state to take action. And we also see a willingness on the part of about half or more in some cases of Californians to pay more money for electricity from renewable sources, to expect to pay more money for gasoline, and a willingness on the part of Californians to understand that sacrifices need to be made. But we also see from Californians a sense of hope that the changes that we're making are going to be a boost to the economy. By about a 2-to-1 margin, people said more jobs as opposed to less jobs as a result of the state's actions on climate change.
That's Mark Baldessari with the Public Policy Institute of California. Mark, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
California farmers need some sun and a lot of water to grow crops. However, in this state, of those two natural renewable resources, there's a lot more sunlight to go around. So as H2O gets more and more scarce, find out why some California growers are looking to the sky to keep their farms afloat. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Much of Los Angeles is built on oil fields, and the industry was a foundation of the city's early prosperity. But that meant a century ago, oil derricks might go up right next to homes. The oil wells are much lower profile nowadays, but many are still there, pumping away, and some are pretty close to homes. This, in recent years, has drawn complaints from residents who say they suffer health problems and other quality of life issues because of them. So activists have been calling for the city to create large new buffers between homes and oil wells and gas fields. The city of LA has been studying this idea for more than 2 years, and this week, the Los Angeles Petroleum Administrator issued a report with some recommendations. KPCC's infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary has gone through it. She's here to tell us all about it. Hello, Sharon.
Hey there.
Report 2 years in the making. Why did it take the city so long to research the health and environmental problems that accompany oil and gas operations?
Well, it's super complicated. It takes in a century of local history and more recent notions of how government should protect public health. The key document out this week is the final report by the Petroleum Administrator. It runs about 160 pages, and it spells out all the different kinds of oil and gas operations in LA, and there are a lot of them, and it recommends some things the city can do to to reduce the health and environmental problems that can come with living near oil and gas wells and these underground storage fields that we've talked about so much. And it's also accompanied by 140 other reports from all the different sources the Petroleum Administrator used in his research. So it's an astonishing trove of information about our local oil operations and their effect on the health of people who live near them.
All right, so let's get to the recommendations. Does the City Petroleum Administrator recommend a buffer zone?
Yes. Okay. The report says a 600-foot buffer zone between homes and schools and other sensitive uses could be imposed as a required setback from oil and gas wells. And it says a buffer like that, combined with new rules to make oil and gas operations safer and quieter, could better protect public health from all the smells and chemicals and potential industrial accidents. A 600-foot buffer could also keep new oil wells from going in. It could put existing oil and gas wells out of compliance with zoning rules and force them to be phased out.
I can imagine people who invest in oil wells are not likely to shut down their operations without a fight, because there's a whole lot of money at stake.
Yeah, the report says a 600-foot buffer would indeed cost the city a lot of money. Requiring existing oil and gas operations to observe a 600-foot limit from homes could cost at least $148 million. That's the money the city might have to pay to compensate the mineral rights owners for the loss of their operations. But litigation, lost production, taxes from the wells could run more than $700 million. But get this, mineral rights owners, even those with no wells operating right now, could lay claim to nearly $100 billion with a B in lost property values based on the future value of the oil and gas that could not be brought to the surface and sold.
Okay, so let me think about this for a second. If the city has to buy the landowners out, where is that money coming from?
To raise the money to create buffer zones, the Petroleum Administrator suggests imposing a new tax on every barrel of L.A. oil pumped from the ground. In the end, it might actually be cheaper to buy up nearby homes and relocate people.
So I got to ask this then. Why are there oil operations close to homes in the first place?
Well, remember our history. Let me give you a super quick rundown. Before we were a showbiz town, we were an oil town. Some parts of Southern California were called Porcupine Hill for all the tall, pointy oil derricks on them. As land values rose in L.A. and all the easy-to-pump oil was depleted, many derricks came down in the 30s and 40s. But then they kind of came back during World War II, you know, and people put up with it because, you know, we were at war. Yeah. But after, they were very unpopular because they were unsightly and loud and smelly. So by the 50s and 60s, oil drilling technologies advanced and the industry came up with this kind of drilling that was supposed to coexist better in densely populated cities, the urban oil drilling site. And now there's more than a dozen of these in LA.
Urban oil drilling site. What is that?
It is dozens of wells crammed close together on a small plot of land. Below the wells, the wells are drilled to reach diagonally out to different pockets of oil.
Wow, very stealthy.
Exactly. I mean, you might see one and not realize what it is, except for the occasional whiff of gas. One drilling site is in the Pico Robertson district. The drilling site occupies a full block. It's surrounded by walls that are designed to look like a synagogue building with a tall tower. But that tower is a disguise. It masks an actual oil derrick that moves back and forth on tracks to all the different oil wells there. And people live and shop right next door to this. And there's other sites. Some are in poor neighborhoods like University Park and the Adams District. A couple are on fancy golf courses.
I know that site that you're talking about. I wouldn't even thought.
Yeah.
So circling back to the issue at hand then, what happens now with this proposed buffer around the oil fields?
It's going to go to several city council committees for debate, lots of debate, and I'm guessing it could be a long while before the city comes up with a workable solution.
All right, and we'll be watching. That's KPCC's infrastructure correspondent, Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, staying with the land, California farmers are looking to solar energy as water supplies become more regulated and unreliable. Plus, converting to solar farms could be critical to reaching some of California's clean energy goals. Now, that's according to a new report by the Nature Conservancy, which looked into what areas should be dedicated to renewable energy and which should be protected. For more on that report and how California farmers are intersecting with clean energy, we turn to Sammy Roth, who covers energy for the LA Times. Sammy, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
All right, so let's start with the big picture. Tell us the reasons why California farmers are turning to solar energy.
Well, you know, I'd say there are two big things. One is just sort of the broad overarching trend that California has renewable energy mandates. Solar has gotten super, super cheap. It's something that's happening everywhere and not just in the Central Valley. But with farmers specifically, you know, one of the big drivers is water. California passed its first law a couple years ago to regulate groundwater. First time the state is ever going to be restricting how much groundwater can be pumped. That's obviously a big source of irrigation for farms in the Central Valley. And we've got regulations that have been restricting more and more how much water the farmers can pull down from the delta up in the Bay Area. So when you look at those factors and look at the amount of land that's already sort of left out of production due to not having enough water or poor soil conditions and the amount that might have to come out in the future, that creates an incentive for these farmers to look at how else can we make money on this land.
Yeah, the land is flat. There's plenty of sunlight. So grow some solar power almost.
That's right. You know, there was one one farm company that said that exact thing to me. They said we look at what we're doing now as growing crops. In the future, we could be growing more electrons.
Now, how have surface water supplies become more unreliable, and how does that affect farmers?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of different things that are happening there, but the big one is that there are these big concerns over the ecology of the Sacramento San Joaquin River Delta. It's up near the Bay Area. It's sort of the heart of the California, water pumping network. And there are endangered fish in the delta, and there's been less water due to drought at various, recent years. And as a result of that, there's just less water being pumped out of there down these rivers and aqueducts to the farmers.
So it makes sense that less water means they can't grow as much as they want to or used to.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the groundwater law is also, going to be a big driver of this. The estimates that I've seen is that of the, 5 million or so irrigated acres in the San Joaquin Valley, that there may need to be 500,000 or even more acres taken out of production in the next two decades to comply with that law.
Talking to Sammy Roth, energy reporter with the LA Times. All right, so the farmers that are converting to solar energy, who are those? Is it like the little farmers, the ones that really need to make some money because water is scarce, or is it the big time farmers as well?
So what I've seen so far is that there are definitely some big players involved with this. I talked to the wonderful company, which is owned by the Stuart and Linda Resnick, and they're looking at converting a lot of their land to solar, land that they've kept out of production. Maricopa Orchards in my story, also a big player. I think one of the things is that with solar, it's more economical if you can go bigger, right? So bigger plots of land, cheaper energy production coming from that. There's an advantage to having large amounts of land where you can do this rather than small amounts of land.
Now, okay, to the Nature Conservancy's new report that really digs into what areas could be dedicated to renewable energy, what were some of the main takeaways from that report?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting report, and what they tried to do was basically look at this big land use challenge. California, to meet its renewable energy goals, we're trying to get 100% clean energy by the middle of the century. That's going to require lots and lots and lots of solar and wind and probably a bunch of other stuff. But looking at the solar and wind specifically, they're trying to figure out, how can we do this? Where can we build this stuff while still protecting the most environmentally sensitive lands? And I would say two of the main conclusions that came out of that is, one, they say we could do it a lot cheaper if we're willing to bring in more clean energy from other states. It opens up more land. It's kind of a straightforward conclusion. And the other one is that the more restrictive, the land use is, the more lands we set aside and say, this is a place we shouldn't touch because of endangered species or because it's prime farmland or for whatever reason, the more lands that are set off from development, also the more expensive it is to meet our goals.
So then which areas in particular maybe could be converted to solar energy without harming the environment?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about the San Joaquin Valley. The really big fight in California with solar and wind and land use over the last 10 years has been out in the desert, where there are really big stretches of sort of undeveloped land where it's easy to grade the land and put thousands of acres of solar panels. But this is also, in a lot of ways, sort of intact wilderness that has a lot of ecological value for sheep and tortoises and all these other critters out in the desert. So there have been reports, including this one and others before it, looking at the San Joaquin Valley and saying, well, yes, there's huge value here in farming, but there's a lot of, again, land that's going to be coming out of production because of water restraints. It's land that's already been degraded environmentally because of the farming that's happening there. It looks like there's really an opportunity there to take some of these lands and convert them to solar without having the same kinds of environmental issues as you might elsewhere.
You know, Sammy, going back for a second to the differences between the big farming operations and the smaller ones, for someone like the Resniks, I mean, is it one of those things where they're just looking for different ways to invest or maybe make some money with all the land they have? They are the biggest landowners in California when it comes to farms, as opposed to maybe a small farm who is looking to stay afloat, to just try and stay open.
I would say that's probably part of it with some of these big companies. They have the land to do it. It's a different way to make money. It's diversifying.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one thing that the representative of the wonderful company, which is the Resniks, who I talked to, said to me that was really interesting. He said that their projection of it is that they think over a 30-year time horizon that they can make about as much money with solar production as they can with almonds or pistachios, which
wow.
are the most lucrative crops. And, you know, that's going to vary based on what the land is and how good it is for solar and what kind of water supply is available. But I was really struck by that that comparison.
Now, okay, so how could converting solar energy play out economically for California? Does it make sense to ditch fossil fuels in this case?
Well, that's a really big question. I think that in general, what the numbers are showing is that solar just continues to get cheaper. Batteries so that you can store it for use at night continue to get cheaper. I mean, the latest estimates are that building new solar and new wind as well in a lot of California and the Southwest is now cheaper than building new gas-fired power plants. Definitely still issues to be worked out with transferring solar from, you know, when the sun is shining to when you need it most, but generally the numbers look good right now.
You know, for better or worse, Sammy, California takes a lot of pride in being such an agriculture powerhouse, feeding pretty much the rest of the United States. So I'm wondering if this is something that gets bigger, if it expands, converting farmland into solar land, what could this mean for the future of agriculture in California?
That's a really great question. I think that's definitely going to be one of the big concerns here and something that is more companies are trying to do this that we'll be hearing more about that from farmers in the San Joaquin Valley who are really nervous about what the future of the valley is and whether it's going to be sustainable to keep doing agriculture in the way that we have. I think the numbers I've seen are that there are a lot of lands in the valley that either have poor soil conditions, drainage problems, stuff that's already been kept out of production. There are definitely places where you can build solar and not have those kinds of conflicts. I think a big question is going to be, are those the lands that solar developers and the landowners target, or is it going to be a conflict where prime farmland is getting taken out of production?
That's Sammy Roth, energy reporter with the LA Times. Sammy, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
LA's homeless population doesn't have a ton of options when it comes to finding shelter. There are nowhere near the number of beds needed to get everyone off the streets. However, some have found a way to have a roof over their heads, but the city of LA says, nope, can't do that. Find out what LA's homeless population will not be able to do when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Yesterday, the LA City Council reapproved a ban on people living in their vehicles in most parts of the city. Supporters of the ban say it keeps neighborhoods safe, but homeless people and their advocates say the law punishes those who have no choice but to sleep in their car. With us here to talk about it more is KPCC's housing reporter, Matt Tinoco. Hello, Matt.
Hi, A.
All right, so Matt, what happened yesterday? I heard it got pretty tumultuous over at City Hall.
Yeah, that's one way to say it. Basically, LA had to reapprove their vehicle dwelling law yesterday because it had expired, and they did that with a 13-0 vote. Thing is, a whole bunch of people came out to City Hall yesterday to speak against the law, and when the vote happened, well, a lot of the people in the council chambers started chanting things like, "Shame on you." And shut it down, basically stopping the entire meeting.
Wow.
So City Hall sergeants then tried to clear the chamber, and when people didn't leave, I know they detained at least one person in handcuffs.
Now, what exactly does the law say? What were they there to speak out against?
The law, it says that nobody can dwell in a vehicle overnight in any of the city's residential neighborhoods. And then it says that at no time can someone dwell in their vehicle anywhere within a block of a school, a park, or a daycare. And the effect basically is that the only places where it is legal to sleep in a vehicle overnight are industrial and commercial areas. Though, again, many times in those areas, they have other parking restrictions that can interfere with that.
So what's the penalty for this?
It's not a big penalty. It's a relatively small fine, actually. It's $25 for a first offense, and then it goes up $25 for each time thereafter. But then, you know, the fines can also add up over time, and it's people who don't really have, you know, money to pay them.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Now, Matt, I feel like we've been here before. This isn't the first time there's been a vote on this, right?
You're very right. This is actually the fourth time in the last 3 years the city council has renewed this ban, this ordinance. So the current vehicle dwelling rules were passed back in November of 2016. But when it was passed with an 18-month sunset, basically an expiration date that would repeal the law on the 1st of July back in 2018, unless it got extended. That's a mouthful, I know, but basically the city council since then, since July of 2018, they keep re-upping it in 6-month increments, which is what they did again in December of last year, and then that one expired on July 1, well, earlier this month.
Why every 6 months? Why do they keep revisiting and then renewing the ban?
I can't say for sure. I emailed the city attorney's office yesterday asking specifically about that, and then when they responded, they didn't answer that question, and they haven't responded to my follow-up yet. But the city has been building up what's called safe parking. Those are lots where people can park their vehicles and sleep in them overnight. It's a model that's been practiced in a number of other jurisdictions with some success, and so it could be that the current law is intended to be temporary while the city evaluates options like safe parking or some other permanent policy for dealing with the increasing number of people who live in their vehicles. The problem really, though, is just how many people there are living in vehicles in Los Angeles. The official estimate for the city of LA is that there are about 9,500 people falling asleep each night in a vehicle.
Wow.
Yeah, but and 9,500 is a lot, but then the reality is that it's probably several times that because it's very, very hard to count. On the flip side, though, as of June, the city had only about 200 spots available in its safe parking lots. By the end of the year, there should be 300, but I mean, 300 is way less than 9,500.
Yeah, a lot less. But okay, so if the city sees safe parking as possibly an alternative, why aren't there more lots?
It costs money, basically. You have to find someone to run the sites, staff the sites, and typically insure them. And there is a limited amount of money. And then also the hardest thing to do is just finding lots because you have to site them and sometimes people around them object to it and it's a whole thing. The most visible part of this are the RVs, but oftentimes the lots can't hold RVs because, well, partially because they're big. Yeah. And then our current rules say that for a vehicle to park in a safe parking lot, it needs to be able to drive on and off under its own power. And well, often the at least within the case of many of the RVs, they aren't actually operable.
Now, okay, let's step back for a second here. You said that there are a huge number of people living in cars. Who are these people?
It's a population as diverse as Los Angeles itself. So as many people as you see on the street living in the sort of makeshift tent encampments, there are many, many more people living in vehicles. You see the RVs because they're so visible, but you've got to recognize that there are many more people just living incognito in regular cars. And really, sleeping in a car is that sort of middle ground between an actual stable living situation and the street, really. And really, sleeping in a car is the sort of middle ground between the street and an actual stable living situation. And it's kind of what happens after you can't couch surf anymore either because, I mean, goodwill lasts only so long.
Yeah.
I want to play a little clip. This is a woman named Robin who lives in a van in the South Bay.
I had a 2-bedroom apartment, and then my husband passed, and I tried to keep it, and then I got sick, and then I fell, and that was it. They sold all my trucks, my plumbing trucks and everything. I'm a plumber.
The stuff was sold to pay her medical bills. And, I mean, this situation is just one of many. It's just what happens to a whole bunch of people. People move into vehicles temporarily and sometimes move in intentionally to save money and they're able to recover. But also a lot of people aren't. So Robin is one of those people. She's disabled and I know she's on supplemental security income. And basically it's everything she can do to hold on to her van. If she loses that van, then basically the next step for her is a tent on the sidewalk.
That's KPCC's Matt Tinoco. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It used to be when an older Hollywood movie star was interested in playing a younger character, they might consider losing weight, getting plastic surgery, insist on creative lighting, and definitely have a great makeup artist on set. Now, looking old actually gets fixed in post. Coming up, find out about the new tech that's not only taking years off of faces, it's slicing decades. That's ahead when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The Lion King photorealistic reboot hits 1 billion mark in under 20 days. Plus, the new de-aging visual effects used in Martin Scorsese's upcoming feature, The Irishman. Let's go on the lot.
God, I wish.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk all things showbiz. Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, A.
All right, so let's check in on the box office first, because I think I might be the only person in the whole wide world that has not seen The Lion King yet. It ranked in nine figures after only 19 days. I mean, how big of a deal is this milestone?
I feel like a broken record every week acknowledging another record set by a Disney film, but they continue to be jaw droppers, and this one is. The Lion King crossed $1 billion, no thanks to A. Martinez, in 19 days. It's not just the size of the audience that's remarkable, but the speed with which the movie found that audience.
Yeah, and that's the thing, too, because I don't like being in that crowd of a theater, so I wanted to wait till it thins out a little bit. That's my excuse, I think.
I'm sticking with that.
Yeah. Okay, so what other films have hit the billion-dollar mark this year?
Well, Captain Marvel, Avengers Endgame, and Aladdin have. Toy Story 4 is about to. And A, you can probably figure out what all of those movies have in common, which is that they're all made by one studio, Disney.
The mouse, Mickey Mouse, making all these movies. Yeah. So what kind of precedent is it setting up for the studio and the future of the box office then?
Well, it's building on the dominance that Disney has had. And there's also more to come that will likely cross the billion-dollar mark this year. There's a Star Wars movie. There's a Frozen sequel on the way. Both of those feel like billion-dollar movies to me. And we've talked about on the show how Disney represents about 40% of the marketplace at the box office right now. It's not something that everybody is thrilled about, not just talking about competing studios, but also movie theaters that worry about how much leverage they'll have with Disney.
Now, okay, so then how does their upcoming streaming service, Disney Plus, maybe play into that dominance?
Well, certainly all of these widely watched movies will ultimately end up on Disney Plus, along with shows that Disney is developing to go directly to the service. It just adds to the enormous cache of intellectual property that Disney has to launch that streaming service. It gives them a real advantage.
I'm going to have to buy it, right? I mean, there's no way around it. If I want to just watch movies, I'm going to have to buy it.
I think it's in the race to see which of the streaming services people are ultimately going to end up with. It's hard to see how Disney doesn't win, particularly in households that have children in them.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on to another film that did pretty well over the weekend. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which had a $40 million debut.
My hands are registered as lethal weapons. We get into a fight. I accidentally kill you. I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
That's a scene from the film depicting Brad Pitt's character gearing up to fight Bruce Lee. Now, Bruce Lee's daughter saw the film over the weekend, did not care for the depiction of her father. What did she have to say about that, about the portrayal?
Yeah, Bruce Lee's daughter Shannon Lee spoke to The Wrap and to the LA Times about her father's portrayal in the movie. She said it was disheartening, that she felt like he came across as a caricature and arrogant, and she felt that the movie, in a way, duplicated the racism that Lee dealt with when he was working in Hollywood in the 1960s.
And she isn't the only person that's upset with that depiction in the film. Matthew Polly is Bruce Lee's biographer. He also chimed in. What factual inaccuracies has he pointed out?
Well, one thing that he pointed out in the rap piece is that in that scene that we just heard a little bit from, Bruce Lee is trash talking Cassius Clay, which Bruce Lee's biographer says would never have happened because he revered the fighter. There's also just sort of the reason for this scene is that Lee is getting into a fight with Brad Pitt's stuntman character. Without revealing how that scene unfolds, I'll just say that Polly, the biographer, found the scene unlikely in its outcome.
Bruce Lee trash-talking Cassius Clay, going to be Muhammad Ali. I mean, that would be amazing if that actually happened in real life. I actually wish it would happen.
I mean, Tarantino takes a lot of poetic license with his movies. He does not try and get every detail completely accurate. It sounds like that particular one was him getting creative.
Any word as to why he wanted to pick Bruce Lee in that way?
You know, Tarantino hasn't commented on these particular stories. He was a huge fan of Bruce Lee, and he may think that this is an homage. It does not seem to have landed that way for people who were close to Lee or who are, you know, major fans of his.
Yeah, and Tarantino, I don't think, really cares too much about what people think about how he makes a film. You know, so I don't know if
he's definitely a guy who likes to just sort of put his film out there. He doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about these kinds of, you know, sort of conversations about representation and portrayal. Like I say, I think he feels that this is a sort of positive portrayal of Lee. Not everybody agrees.
Now, Sharon Tate, Roman Polanski, Steve McQueen were also portrayals in this film. Just curious, any criticism about how those people were presented?
Well, in some ways, they're more sympathetic than the portrait of Lee. Although I will say, at Cannes, some people were bothered by the fact that the Sharon Tate character, who's played by Margot Robbie, has very little dialogue. The movie kind of follows her. She goes and sees one of her own movies in the theater. She picks up a hitchhiker. She seems to be sort of embodying a spirit of the 60s in a way that some critics felt wasn't a sort of whole character herself.
That's when Tarantino answered the reporter's question by saying, "I reject your hypothesis."
Yes, he did not like that critique when the reporter brought it to him at the press conference at Cannes.
All right, so let's talk about another director now, Martin Scorsese. He just dropped the first trailer for his upcoming film, The Irishman.
Hello?
Is that Frank?
Yes.
Hiya, Frank. This is Jimmy Hoffa.
Glad to meet you.
Glad to meet you, too, even if it's over the phone. Our friend speaks very highly of you.
Thank you.
Only three people in the world have one of these. And only one of them is Irish.
All right, Scorsese, De Niro, Pacino. I mean, I'm already going to see it. I mean, that's not even a question.
I know. We're all in the tank.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so what do we know about the premise?
Oh, this is based on the book, I Heard You Paint Houses. De Niro plays Frank Sheeran, a labor union leader and a mob hitman. Al Pacino plays Jimmy Hoffa. Sheeran is said to have played a role in Hoffa's disappearance. So it feels a little bit sort of Goodfellas-esque, yeah, but it's got an element of an Irish character set in Philly instead.
Now, Rebecca, in that trailer, I couldn't help but notice that they look a little different. In some parts of the trailer, they look a certain age, and in other parts, they look a lot younger. Why do they do that?
Well, the story spans many decades. It's told in part in flashback, and at one point, De Niro and Pacino are meant to be men in their 30s or 40s.
De Niro 75, Pacino 79. How did they do that?
Yes, this is not a Beverly Hills plastic surgeon who got this done. This is done using zeros and ones. Scorsese shot the scenes that take place when the actors are younger digitally so that visual effects artists at Industrial Light and Magic could manipulate them to de-age them. We've seen this technology before, for instance, in the most recent Avengers movie, which had 200 de-aging shots in order to accomplish some time travel. Different technologies used on this movie that will be out this fall called Gemini Man, where you see a 23-year-old Will Smith hunting the 50-year-old Will Smith.
Do they hold up? Do the visual effects hold up?
I think it varies from film to film and how the filmmakers use them. It's no question an interesting technology. And one, if I were a younger actor who looked like De Niro, Pacino, or Will Smith, I'd be kind of disappointed about.
Yeah, the younger version of A. Martinez won't need any special effects. Not at all.
Yeah.
Just a time machine. That's the only thing. Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about all things showbiz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
If you missed any part of the show today, go right to wherever you get your podcasts and just look for the Take Two Show. You can find out everything that we talked about today. You can also find us on shows on social media at Take Two or at Take Two. You can find me there at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then. Toward your destination.